5. Their trip to Berea Baptist Church on Sunday was memorable. Kaylee, who attended church only infrequently, mostly because of doctrinal differences, stayed at home to guard the roost. Lars, Beth, and Grace drove to church in Beth's Saturn View, since it got better mileage than Lars' Dodge Durango. They expected a light turnout. From what they had heard, the gasoline shortage had spooked many people into extreme conservation mode. Others were afraid to leave their homes unattended for fear of burglary. As they pulled off of Blanco Road into the church parking lot, Lars chuckled and pointed to the overflow parking lot behind the church, which now had 15 horses hitched up to a newly erected rail. Saddles were draped over a row of 55-gallon drums resting on their sides, lined up in a phalanx. After they parked their car, they stepped over to the fence to look at the horses and saddles. Grace exclaimed,
"Ooh, Daddy, are we going to get a horse?"
"Probably very soon, Anneli," Lars replied, using her pet name, which was Finnish for Grace. Beth pointed and said,
"Notice that three of those are pack saddles?"
Lars replied, "That's odd." He made a mental note to donate some more drums, since if the trend in transportation in this new era of insanely expensive gasoline continued, the church would soon need room for more saddles. He could spare the drums, since he had a dozen that had been painted white for use in horseback barrel racing back in the 1970s, but they were now useless for storing fluid, since their bottoms were badly rusted. After walking through the sanctuary to the building's multipurpose room for their usual pre-church cup of coffee, they saw that the room was newly lined with two rows of pallet boxes on both sides for donations. These were marked canned food, perishables, women's clothing, boys' clothing, girls' shoes, and so forth. As they walked by them, Beth said,
"Let's sort through some extra clothes and shoes that Grace has outgrown to donate."
Lars nodded in agreement. Ray, the leader of their adult Sunday school class, was there as usual, but he looked a bit self-conscious, carrying a SIG P250 in a hip holster, with four spare magazines and open-top pouches on the opposite hip. Lars said reassuringly,
"I'm glad to see you're packing. Thanks for making everyone feel safer. Even though the police department is right across the road, we can't be too careful."
As they sat down at one of the classroom tables, Beth asked quietly,
"Is there any way we can still buy handguns?"
Lars shook his head.
"No way, hon. You'd have to trade a couple of new cars to get a decent pistol these days."
During the prayer and praise time before the class began, when prayer requests were made, a black teenager, who the Lanes didn't recognize, stood up and announced,
"You folks don't know me, or us. My name is Shadrach Phelps. My friends and I would appreciate your prayers. The three of us come from an orphanage over in Rio Arriba County that was closing down. We don't have any place to go, and we're looking for work around here, even for just room and board and hay for our horses. We're all hard workers. We each got our own horses and tack. We can buck hay all day long, split wood, butcher deer, and we know which end of the shovel goes in the ground. Oh, and, of course, we're Christians. We're trusting in God's providence. Thing is, we all want to get hired on somewhere together. We're tight, so we don't want to split up. Anyway, again, we'd appreciate your prayers."
Phelps gave an embarrassed grin as he sat down. As he did, there were murmurs throughout the classroom. After the Sunday school class, the Lanes approached the Phelps boys. They were talking with a widow that Lars recognized as the owner of a ranch near Bloomfield. Chad Phelps was gesturing, pointing to his friends.
"I'm sorry, but if you can't take all three of us, then I'll have to say no. But thank you."
The woman nodded and turned away. Lars approached Shadrach Phelps and shook his hand. He looked Shad in the eye and pronounced,
"My father always used to say, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, then go together. I'd like you young men to come work for me and my wife at our ranch. I think that we'll go far together.
Hiring the boys was a straightforward arrangement, but feeding their six horses was a bit more complicated. When Lars and Beth first took over the ranch, they found that Tim Rankin had not done a very good job of maintenance. The little brush and roller painting that he had done had left copious spatters, and the spray painting had left obvious overspray. The Elder Lane saddles were still there, but Rankin had borrowed and never returned their girth straps, as well as several horse pads and blankets. At least Rankin had been vigilant about poisoning the mice and pack rats, and he had done a decent job of weed control in the pastures. Lars and Andy were both away on active duty when Tim Rankin moved into the house. When they asked about their father's guns, Rankin said that he hadn't found any in the house. This made Lars and Andy suspicious, because they knew that their father owned several guns. Since these guns had mostly sentimental value, they didn't push the issue with Rankin, who pled, "Well, if they were in the house, they must have been burglarized before I ever got there. There were a lot of strangers in the house after your dad passed on. The paramedics, the cops, the coroner, and probably more. Any one of them could have lifted your dad's guns." When Tim Rankin left, there were still 2 tons of year-old alfalfa hay in the hay barn and about 3 tons of baled straw in the stable loft. As soon as his job offers to the Phelps boys were accepted, Lars started to make inquiries about hay, grain, and firewood. After much searching and dickering, he bartered a mint-condition U.S. $5 gold piece in exchange for 9 tons of alfalfa, 5 cords of pinyon pine firewood, 7 salt blocks, and 200 pounds of molasses-sweetened cob, a mix of cracked corn, rolled oats, and barley. Lars felt that he got the worst end of the deal, because gold was then selling for $8,460 per ounce. Since not even counting its numismatic value, the $5 gold piece contained almost 1/4 ounce of gold, Lars felt cheated. The ranch's pair of 15-acre irrigated pastures were in decent shape, but to be useful to their full capacity once again, they needed to be reseeded. The local feed store still had some sacks of orchard grass pasture blend seed on hand. It took some dickering, but Lane was able to get 50 pounds of the seed blend in exchange for 3 silver quarters and a box of 50 .22 long rifle cartridges. Lane soon put the Phelps boys to work, broadcasting half of the sack of seed with a hand-cranked broadcaster, primarily in the pasture's many bare spots. But the more difficult work came in the next 2 weeks, when they laboriously raked the seed into the soil. They also had to be vigilant in scaring off any passing birds until after the seed had sprouted. Like so many other things that had previously been taken for granted, grass seed had become a precious commodity. It was after the orphans arrived that Lars also discovered that Tim Rankin had pilfered most of the horse care tools and veterinary supplies for his father's horses. There was little left other than a couple of half-empty jars of SWAT fly repellent. Luckily, the boys had brought with them a pair of hoof nippers, a hoof rasp, a brush, and 2 horse combs. Diego Aguilar had also providently sent along a 16-ounce bulk can of horse wormer. Instead of using a mouth syringe, like the one Lars had previously used, the boys heavily coated a mouth bit with the paste and attached the bit, just as they would do for riding. Giving a horse a double handful of sweet feed then ensured that the medicine went down. While the Diego method of dosing was less accurate, Lane presumed that it was effective.
Chapter 18. Rock and Roll. Note that Finland's 5 million people own 4 million personal firearms. Just wait till Congressman Schumer finds out about that. Jeff Cooper, Jeff Cooper's Commentaries, Volume 3, Number 2, January 1995. Stowing the boys' tack and moving into the bunkhouse didn't take long, as they hadn't carried much gear. The bunkhouse was utilitarian, but well insulated. The interior walls were covered with unpainted plywood. It had two narrow rooms that sat side by side, each with their own door, off the foyer. One of them had a window at one end with some gauzy curtains and two sets of bunk beds that were positioned end to end. The other room didn't contain much except for about 30 boxes, most of which contained National Geographic magazines that had belonged to Lane's maternal grandmother. Some of these dated back to the 1930s. Both of the rooms were heated by a barrel wood stove on a low flagstone pedestal in the foyer. Soon after moving in and starting their monthly rotating OP duty shifts, the boys realized that one of them would have to sleep during the day, but the daylight would make it difficult for that individual to sleep. So Shad asked Lars if they could move the bunk beds to the other room, which could be kept completely dark. Lars gave his consent. But just 10 minutes later, Shad returned to the house, looking confused.
"Mr. Lane, there's something wrong with that other room in the bunkhouse."
"What do you mean, wrong?"
"When the bunk beds were in the south room, they fit fine. But now, when we move them into the other room, they don't fit. That's weird, because the rooms are supposed to be the same length. Can you come and take a look?"
Lars pulled a 25-foot tape measure from his desk drawer and followed Shad to the bunkhouse. With the tape measure, they found that the windowless room was 6 inches shorter than the other. Lars chuckled. Pulling the bunk back from the far wall, he began rapping with his knuckles in various places on the plywood, listening for differences in sounds. Lars half sang, "Methinks my dad did some creative carpentry here."
"So, it's like a fake wall?" Reuben asked.
"Yes, I suspect that it is. Give me just a minute."
Leaving the boys, Lane walked briskly to the shop and soon returned with his Makita cordless screw gun. Starting at the middle of the wall at chest level, Lars began backing out the sheetrock screws that held the plywood in place at 16-inch intervals. He was surprised when the first screw dropped to the floor after just a few turns. Looking down at the screw, he saw that it was just a stub.
"That's odd. Must have broken off."
The same thing happened with the next screw.
"What the?"
Lars exclaimed. Reaching down, he picked up the two fallen screws. They were both just 3/8 of an inch long. Examining them closely, he observed,
"These didn't break. These were sawed off with a hacksaw."
Lars resumed removing the plywood sheet's screws in front of him. He found that most of the screws had been shortened and installed just to give the appearance of functional fasteners. But only 6 of them, 4 in the corners and 2 that were at the midpoint of the plywood sheet, were a full 2 inches in length and went through to the studs behind.
"Oh, Dad, you clever Finn. Take a look at this, guys. This panel is designed to be removed with only 6 screws to take out."
"Here, help me with this," said Lars, as he backed the last screw out of the upper left corner. Lane and the boys bounced the 3/4-inch thick sheet of plywood loose and pulled it away, revealing a cavity behind that was crammed full of stacked ammo cans, mostly U.S. Army surplus cans originally made to hold 30-caliber ammunition, and several odd-shaped items wrapped in heavy black plastic trash bags sealed with priority mail packing tape. Starting with the 3rd row of ammo cans, all of the items were held in place either with hardware wire attached to screw eyes or hung from closet hooks. It was now obvious that his father had added a framework of 2x6s at the far end of the room and covered it to look like the original wall. Given the dimensions of the rooms, the difference in their depths was almost imperceptible. Lars began laughing as he started pulling the contents from the wall cache.
You boys may have heard that us Finns are the quiet, stoical type. Well, my dad, his first name was Robbie, fit that description to a T. My mom said that my dad would go for days at a time without much more than grunts and a good morning and a good night. He never told me about this wall, and my mom and my brother never mentioned it either, so I suppose that he kept it all to himself.
After a pause, he added, and since he died suddenly of a heart attack after my mom died, he never got the chance. It took the better part of the afternoon for him to inventory the gear. Meanwhile, Shad and Reuben used the Makita to remove other sheets of plywood throughout the bunkhouse, checking for more hidden compartments. They found none. Starting first with the plastic-wrapped guns, Lane found four Finnish M39 bolt-action rifles, almost identical to his own rifle, except that one of them was built on an early hexagonal receiver, and they had barrels from different makers. One was a Tikka, two were made by Valmet, marked VKT, and the other was made by Seiko. Always thorough and safety-conscious, Robbie Lane had attached tags to the trigger guard of each gun that read, "Grease in bore and chamber, remove before firing." Inside one of the plastic bags was a zippered green canvas case that, when unzipped, revealed an M1 carbine equipped with M2 conversion parts. Lars exclaimed,
"Son of a... this thing is rock and roll."
Shad asked,
"You mean it's a full auto?"
"Well, technically the term is selective fire, because it will shoot either semi-auto or full auto." After checking the gun's chamber to ensure that it was unloaded, Lane thumbed the carbine selector lever on the left side of the receiver, explaining, "The rear position here is semi-auto, but when it's flipped forward, it's full auto. A lot of guys converted M1 carbines into M2s back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, since the conversion parts were pretty widely available, and it doesn't require any modification of the receiver." Shad grinned and said,
"Oh, yeah. I read about M2 carbines once in a gun magazine. But that's a major bust if you get caught with it."
Lars went on, "Yes, legally it's a contraband gun, but given the present circumstances, I think that's about to become a non-issue, if it isn't one already. But just the same, I don't think that I'll go around advertising that I have an unregistered Class 3 gun. I'd appreciate it if you'd also keep your lips zipped." Shad said, "Yes, sir." The other boys gave exaggerated nods. In another canvas case, this one reinforced with green leather at the ends, was a Valmet M62, the Finnish equivalent of the Russian AK-47, with a tubular stock. Lane let out a whistle when he saw the gun. He knew that the Valmet was considered the Cadillac of the AK family, and very valuable. One ammo can held 11 spare magazines for the M2 carbine, and another had 7 green plastic waffle magazines for the Valmet M62. There were also various slings and pouches for magazines and an odd-looking bayonet for the Valmet M62 in a green leather sheath. It was marked Fiskars. To Lars, it looked more like a filleting knife than a bayonet. Later, after the boys went into the house to help get dinner ready, Lars was examining the Valmet M62 and realized that it, too, was selective fire. Looking closely, he saw that instead of just 2 positions, the safety selector had 3 positions, with 1 in the middle for full auto fire. He concluded that it was an original Finnish Defense Force M62, rather than a converted civilian production Valmet. Later, he told Beth that the gun had probably been smuggled into the U.S. by his uncle Aki, who for many years was an engineering officer on a Finnish merchant marine ship. The last of the guns was a Lahti 9mm semi-auto pistol with 5 spare magazines wrapped in brown waxed paper, along with an original Finnish military holster. The pistol had a single-column magazine and looked vaguely like a Luger. It had plastic grips marked VKT. Lars chortled when he saw that and put on a deep radio announcer's voice.
Yet another fine product from the industrious workers at Valmet.
He explained to Lisbeth that since the end of World War II, Valmet had expanded into a conglomerate, branching out to make everything from log harvesters to military aircraft. Lars had read about Lotti pistols, but he had never handled one. Finally, Lane began to inventory the ammunition in detail. In all, there were 1,100 rounds of 7.62 by 54R for the bolt actions, almost 1,500 rounds of 30 caliber carbine, 1,280 rounds of 7.5-39 for the Valmet M62, and 650 rounds of 9mm for the Lotti. He was thrilled to find that one of the 30 caliber ammo cans was filled not with ammo, but with rolls of pre-1965 silver quarters. It was not until the next day that Lars had the opportunity to examine the can holding the rolls of silver quarters. When he emptied it out to count the rolls, he found a sealed envelope tucked in alongside the rolls. It was marked Lars and Anders in his father's handwriting. He opened it and found a typewritten letter. It read,
"My dear sons, it was my intention to give you these coins when you'd both graduated from high school. But back then, I had my doubts about your maturity, so I decided to hold on to them until after you earned your commissions. I want you to appreciate these silver quarters for what they really are, not just an investment and not just a family heirloom. They represent real money. Pardon the lecture, but you need to judge their value 4 ways, in terms of wages, manufactured goods, services, and real property. First, let's look at wages. Back in the old days, say before World War I, the average wage for a working man was around $1 a day. 1 day's wage right now for someone that works at a minimum wage job at $7.25 per hour is $58 for an 8-hour workday. A more typical wage for a workman with experience is around $11 per hour, $88 per day. $1 face value in 90% silver pre-1965 coinage contains 22.5 grams of silver or 0.7234 troy ounces per dollar face value. Today's spot price of silver is $17.55 per troy ounce, so that makes a pre-inflation dollar, a true dollar in silver coin, worth $12.79. Or just think of it as roughly 13 times $1 in face value. 13 times face, whether it is silver dimes, quarters, or half dollars. So to put things in perspective, it takes $6.76 in pre-65 silver coinage to equal 1 typical day's wages, $88 in the current fiat paper money. Thus, in terms of wages, silver should have a spot value about 5 or 6 times its current value. By this measure, silver is now grossly undervalued. Next, manufactured goods. In 1964, the last year that silver coins were in general circulation in the U.S., a basic blued steel Colt Model 1911 45 caliber automatic pistol cost around $65 retail. Today, a comparable Colt M1911, a Series 80, costs around $775 retail. So, if you were to sell $65 face value of this cash of silver coinage at your local coin shop, and they offered you 12 times face That would net you $780 in the current funny money. You could then easily go buy a .45 at your local gun shop with the proceeds. The bottom line? It is not pistols that have gone up in price. Rather, it is paper dollars that have gone down in purchasing power. How about services? In 1964, a haircut cost around 75 cents, or perhaps a dollar in the big city. My last haircut cost $14. I suspect that other services are comparable, whether it is your local dentist or your local brothel. I trust and pray that neither of you will ever use the latter service. Now let's look at the relative values of silver coinage and real property. In 1964, the median house price in the U.S. was around $18,000. Today, it is around $170,000, a 9.4 times increase. If you had set aside $18,000 face value in silver coins in 1964, 18 bags of $1,000 face value each, and held them until the present day, they'd net you around $216,000 if you sold them to a bullion coin dealer. That is enough for an above-average house. So obviously, silver coins have held their value far better than paper dollars. Anyone who sits on paper dollars for very long, at least dollars that aren't earning much interest, is a fool. I hope and pray that you keep investing in silver. You should acquire much more than this little nest egg. In my opinion, you can trust tangibles, like silver and guns, but you shouldn't put much trust in paper currency in the long term. To safeguard your net worth in the inflationary days to come, always remember, don't leave your earnings in paper money for long. As quickly as possible, convert it into tangibles to protect your savings from the ravages of inflation. Consumer price inflation is mild now, but that probably won't be the case in the near future. So adjust your way of thinking and doing business accordingly. Never forget, inflation is a hidden form of taxation. Divide these coins equally between you. Spend them wisely, and up until the day that the balloon goes up, spend them only as a last resort, and never forget their real worth. Love, Dad. As Lars tucked the letter back into the envelope, he said resolutely, "Yeah, Dad, you were right." Each of the Phelps boys was given one of the M39 bolt-action rifles in lieu of their first 2 months' wages. The next day, a few precious rounds of the hard-kicking 7.62-54R were used to sight in each of their rifles. Because that ammo was corrosively primed, Lane showed the boys how to carefully clean the rifle's bores and bolt faces, making sure that they cleaned their barrels for several successive days to be sure that all traces of corrosive priming salts had been removed. The bunkhouse was soon decorated with a Monument Valley poster and maps from National Geographic magazines. The boys settled into a routine of guard shifts, caring for their horses, some house chores, and reading. Lots of reading. Having the Phelps boys at the ranch was a great relief to Lars, Beth, and Kaylee, who up until then were starting to feel the strain of guarding the ranch by themselves. Lars' morning routine was to first pray at dawn silently, and then cuddle with his wife. Then he would sit up and put on his eye patch and his prosthetic hand. As needed, he'd put some silicone cream on the stump first. Lars had learned that the size of his residual limb changed during each day. Fluid pooled in the limb at night when the prosthesis was off and was pushed back out when Mr. President was strapped on. Thus, the fit was slightly tighter in the morning than in the afternoon or evening. Still in his pajamas,
Lars did 20 rapid push-ups and 40 sit-ups. Then he'd shower and get dressed. Before the crunch, he would also read his email and have a cup of coffee with breakfast. But both of those diversions soon became just memories. In recent days, he would eat at the kitchen table with Matthew Phelps, who was the early riser of the Phelps trio. Chapter 19. Gainful. As every individual, therefore, endeavors as much as he can, both to employ his capital in the support of domestic industry and so to direct that industry that its produce may be of the greatest value, every individual necessarily labors to render the annual revenue of the society as great as he can. He generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest, nor knows how much he is promoting it. By preferring the support of domestic to that of foreign industry, he intends only his own security. And by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of the greatest value, he intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for the society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. Adam Smith, Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, 1776. Lars and Beth Lane were cuddled in bed by the light of a single candle. For the first time in many days, they rested comfortably, knowing that one of the boys would be on guard duty all night long, listening and watching for intruders. Beth asked,
"How are we going to make do? Your disability retirement checks are still coming, but they're a joke. The check for 1 month might buy a couple of days' worth of groceries, if we're lucky. And at the rate things are going, in another couple of weeks, a check might just buy one can of beans."
Lars sighed. "Well, we aren't going to make a living on 20 acres in this country, especially with 7 or 8 mouths to feed. If we just barter for food and fuel, our stash of precious metals will eventually get depleted. It's pretty clear that I need to look for work, putting my military training to use."
"What? As a mercenary?"
"Not exactly. There are a lot of businesses in town that are doing a pitiful job of securing what they have. Whether it's a burglary or a robbery at gunpoint, they know that sometime within a few months somebody is going to come and clean them out. It's only the refinery that seems to have their act together so far in terms of security. So I think I ought to go hire myself out as a security consultant. I could set them up some rudimentary physical security. Maybe I could team up with one of the welding shops on that, and also train their employees on shooting and small team tactics." Stroking his wife's back, he added, "Now that we discovered my dad's guns and that silver, I also have some leverage in bartering situations. I'd like your blessing to poke around town and see what happens." Beth sighed.
"That sounds good to me. You just be careful and proceed with prayer."
Upgrading the security at the Lane's ranch went quickly, with the help of the boys. The main task was constructing an observation post, OP, with railroad ties. Lars carefully positioned it on a gentle rise, 52 yards from the southwest corner of the house. From there, there was a good view of the house, barn, and bunkhouse. The OP measured just 6 feet square and 5 feet high. By heaping split pinyon pine rounds over it, they made it look like a nondescript pile of firewood. After building the OP, they moved on to upgrading the house itself for defense against looters. Lars was fond of saying, "When it comes to stopping bullets, there's nothing like mass, and sandbags are cheap mass."
It was clear that they'd need sandbags. Lots of sandbags. There were 16 empty feed sacks in the barn. These had been made to hold 50 pounds of grain, so they were oversized for their needs. If filled with sand, they would have weighed more than 100 pounds. So Lars cut each sack in half and restitched the cut-off ends to form additional sacks using a large, curved upholstery needle. This task was just like the sailcloth stitching that his Uncle Aki had taught Lars when he was 12 years old. But this yielded just 32 sandbags, not nearly enough for their needs. They made inquiries all over Farmington and Bloomfield, but found that all of the available feed sacks had already been bought up by others with the same idea. After a few days of searching, they heard that feed sacks were still available from Southwest Seed, 60 miles away in Dolores, Colorado. Unlike a typical retail feed store, this was a seed packing and grain elevator operation set up to handle wholesale quantities. When he arrived, Lars was not surprised to see several armed men guarding the feed and seed complex. They were, after all, guarding something quite valuable. The sales manager walked Lars around. He pointed out their inventory, which included many pallets of brand new bundled feed sacks. Most of them were white, but about one-third of the 20-pound size were tan. It was those that Lane wanted, since they were the right size for sandbags, and they'd blend in well in desert country. Negotiating the sack purchase took a while. This reminded Lars of transactions he'd witnessed several years before at the bazaar in Basra, Iraq. It started with pleasantries, followed by a few outrageous offers and counteroffers, and finally some serious dickering for more realistic prices. They eventually agreed on $4.50 face value in pre-1965 quarters and 200 rounds of 22 long rifle rimfire cartridges in exchange for 600 empty tan sacks. While he was there, Lars also bought 40 more pounds of pasture blend for $1.20 face value in silver dimes. It was more than Lane needed, but he anticipated that it would be good to keep on hand for barter. Life at the Lane's ranch was comfortable, at least by post-crunch standards. Everyone had enough to eat, and the rotating security shifts were just 4 hours per day from Monday through Saturday and 6 hours on Sundays. They soon instituted L&L's standing rules. These rules were penned on a large piece of cardstock by Lisbeth and posted inside the door of the bunkhouse. 1. If in doubt, sound the alarm. 2. Keep all doors locked 24/7. 3. Never leave the house unarmed. 4. Never leave the house without a walkie-talkie. 5. Always carry at least 40 rounds of ammunition with each bolt-action rifle and at least 3 magazines for semi-autos. 6. Treat every approaching stranger as a potential enemy. 7. Keep your friends close and your enemies at 9x distance. 8. No guard quits their post unless properly relieved. 9. Severe punishment for anyone who falls asleep while on watch. 10. Horse grooming and hoof work daily without fail. 11. No lights visible from outside after dark. 12. Good stewardship in all things, no wasteful behavior. 13. Keep proper sanitation and cleanliness. 14. Leave every gate the way you found it unless told otherwise. 15. Maintain everything to last a lifetime. It may have to. 16. Rust is an enemy. Oil and grease are allies. 17. Maintain the need-to-know rule. No loose lips. 18. Courteous behavior and Christian attitudes, always. 19. No foul or blasphemous language. 20. Respect everyone's privacy. 21. 100% effort. No slacking on chores. 22. Health and safety are top priorities. 23. Watch for signs of dehydration and hypothermia, self and others. 24. Be honest and forthright in all business dealings. 25. Recognize the head of the house as final authority on all decisions. 26. Count your blessings. 27. Be charitable and tithe consistently. 28. Smile. God loves you. You are in His covenant. Below that, Lisbeth added a quote from her favorite psalm. The Lord knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. Psalm 37, 18 and 19. Chapter 20. Tentacles. The government turns every contingency into an excuse for enhancing power in itself. John Adams. Fort Knox, Kentucky, November the first year. Maynard Hutchings and his council that headed the provisional government soon consolidated their power in Kentucky and much of Tennessee, declaring themselves the sole and legitimate provisional government of the United States of America and possessions, with Hutchings himself voted by his council as president pro tempore. The provisional government spread its sphere of influence rapidly. Any towns that resisted were quickly crushed. The mere sight of dozens of tanks and APCs was enough to make most townspeople cower in fear. Anything that the Prov.gov couldn't accomplish through intimidation, it accomplished with bribes. The new currency was spread around lavishly among the Hutchings cronies. Covertly, some criminal gangs were hired as security contractors and used as enforcers of the administration's nationalization schemes. Some of these gangs were given military vehicles and weapons and promised booty derived from eliminating other gangs that were not as cooperative. Hit squads were formed to stifle any dissent. These did so through abductions, arson, and murder. Nobody was ever able to prove a link, but an inordinately large number of conservative members of Congress from the old government disappeared or were reported killed by bandits. Some foreign troops were clothed in U.S. ACU digital or OCP camouflage, but most foreign troops stayed in their own uniforms and were used as shock troops to eliminate any pockets of resistance. Disaffection with the new government smoldered everywhere that they went to pacify. Within the first 3 months of launching the new government, Hutchings was in contact via satellite with the UN's new headquarters in Brussels to request peacekeeping assistance. The old UN building in New York had been burned, and the entire New York metropolitan region was 9/10 depopulated and controlled by hostile gangs. Hutchings had at first naively assumed that the UN's assistance would be altruistic, with no strings attached. It was only after the first UN troops started to arrive in large numbers that it became clear that UN officers would control the operation. Eventually, Hutchings became little more than a figurehead. The real power in the country was held by the UN administrators. They had their own chain of command that bypassed the Hutchings administration, and they had direct control over the military. One closely guarded secret was that Maynard Hutchings signed an agreement that promised payment of 30 metric tons of gold from the Fort Knox depository to defray the costs of transporting and maintaining a mixed contingent of UN peacekeepers, mostly from Germany, Holland, and Belgium. The gold was shuttled out of the country in half-ton increments in flights from Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
There had also been the offer of Chinese peacekeeping troops, but Hutchings insisted that no Asian or African troops be used on American soil, saying, "I want it to be all white fellas that'll blend in."
In early December, Lars Lane made an appointment to meet with Elroy Martin at his office. Although Lane's daily uniform around the ranch was a pair of khaki pants and a digital ACU shirt, his best bet to blend in, given the predominant local sagebrush over sandy soil, he decided to brush his tan leather combat boots and wear his full ACU uniform. He even de-sterilized it, slapping on a Velcro flag on the shoulder, a subdued oak leaf on the center of his chest, and a Lane name tape. Beth suggested that he wear his tan eye patch, saying, "It's better you look rugged, rather than him spending the whole time eyeballing your glass eye." Only Beth could say something like that to Lars without him feeling the least offended. She always knew what to wear to a party. As Lars drove back from shopping, he passed a group of men who were constructing a reinforced fighting position beside the road on a low hill, about halfway between Farmington and Bloomfield. It was obviously part of the sheriff's posse work on Bloomfield roadblocks that he had heard about. They observed his passing vehicle suspiciously, and two of them stepped toward their rifles until they saw the license plate prefix. Lars drove up to the refinery's gates and was not surprised to see that they were closed and manned by a pair of guards armed with both M1A rifles and holstered pistols. One of them had a clipboard. Lars rolled down his window and announced, "Major Lars Lane, I have an appointment with Mr. Martin." Lars was asked for his ID, and the guard took 20 seconds to closely examine it, comparing it with the notes on his clipboard. This obviously was not just a perfunctory, wave-them-through sort of stop. As the guard was looking at Lane's driver's license and military ID card, Lars sized up the guard. He was in his early 30s and had a buzz cut. He had the bearing of an Army or Marine Corps veteran. He wore unmarked ACUs, desert boots, IBA, and slightly scratched Oakley sunglasses and a tan baseball cap for the full-on Special Forces operator look. And just as he was being handed back his ID cards, Lars noticed a woven texture on the back of the well-worn clipboard. It was one of the Executive Protection Kevlar clipboards that he had seen in Iraq. Clearly, these guys were not your everyday rent-a-cops. The guard whispered a code phrase on a handy-talkie, and 10 seconds later, the electric gate opened. Lars drove up to the plant's administrative office, a nondescript, windowless concrete slab tilt-up building that looked recently constructed. He stepped out of the cab and slung his Valmet across his back. To Lars, the building looked normal, except that he could see a parapet of sandbags at one corner of the roof. And then, as he approached the building, he noticed the front door, which had probably originally been glass, had been replaced with what appeared to be plywood, painted dark gray to match the building. A neatly printed sign with an arrow read, "Press buzzer and identify yourself. Door is heavy. Pull hard." Lars pressed the button and looked up at a CCTV camera. "Major Lars Lane?" A moment later, a buzzer sounded, and Lane pulled the door open. It was indeed very heavy. As he swung it open, he could see that the plywood was just a veneer, covering an unpainted sheet of half-inch thick plate steel. After he stepped through, the spring-loaded door automatically closed behind him with a click. Lane turned to see that there was a green indicator light shining above the door and that there were heavy metal brackets installed to manually bar the door. He turned forward again to see that he was in a narrow passageway just over 3 feet wide and 9 feet long, with a cinder block wall on one side, the building's slab outer wall on the other side, and tongue-and-groove 8-inch planks sheeted above. At the end of the hallway was another door, also steel, this one unpainted, and he was again under the lens of a CCTV camera. He heard the inner door being unbarred. After a pause,
A woman's voice on the intercom announced, "You may proceed." Pushing open the inner door, which seemed even heavier, it looked like 3/4-inch plate steel, Lars came into an entry foyer. A trim woman in her 30s with a stubby, breaching riot shotgun slung at her side greeted him.
"Good morning, sir. Mr. Martin is ready to see you. Follow me."
She walked him past mainly empty desks to the far end of the building. Lisbeth would have been happy to see that Lars was giving attention to the secretary's Remington riot gun, and not her rear end. As Lane was ushered into Martin's office, he was taken aback to see that instead of a paneled executive office, it appeared to be a converted storage room with no decorations. Martin had a round face and a middle-aged paunch. He wore suit pants, a polo shirt, and small Giorgio Armani wire-framed eyeglasses. Martin had what Lars called a desk jockey physique. Martin was seated behind an odd square desk that was constructed a bit like a church pulpit, with slab sides that went all the way to the floor. A Kenwood multiband transceiver and a police scanner sat stacked on one corner of the desk. Their antenna coax cables went straight up to the ceiling, adding to the utilitarian look of the office.
"Take a seat," Martin said with a wave.
As he did, resting the Valmet across his thighs, Lane realized that the desk where Martin sat was probably constructed out of plate steel and just covered with wood for show. Martin began,
"I've heard some good things about you."
"Likewise, and I'm impressed with your security around here."
"You were in the Army?"
"Yeah, I was branched civil affairs. I got out as an 04.
Martin responded,
"I heard that was becoming its own branch just as I was leaving the Army. Times change."
"Yeah, Iraq and Afghanistan changed a lot of things for the Army. Low-intensity conflict, nation-building, all that."
Recognizing the distinctive cheese-grater black forend on Lane's rifle, Martin intoned,
"That's a Valmet, isn't it?"
"You sure know your guns?"
"Yes, it's a Valmet. It belonged to my father. Before he passed away, he collected guns from Finland, since he was Finnish."
"But I thought your family name was English."
"Lane, without the I, is English, but Lane with the I is fairly common for folks of Finnish descent."
"Oh, I see."
After an awkward pause, Elroy asked, "Can you sum up your military experience?" "I did 3 tours, one in Afghanistan and 2 in Iraq. I spent a lot of time outside the wire. Civil affairs officers mainly do host country liaison. That got dicey at times. I was an IPI liaison. That stands for Indigenous Populations and Institutions. I picked up a bit of Pashto and a conversational level of Arabic. I was nearly done with my 3rd tour when I got this present, courtesy of some jihadi Otvek who was given some electronics goodies by the Iranians." Lane raised his prosthetic hand and rotated it at the wrist. "So I hear that you want to set up roadblocks, like the ones they're building around Farmington."
"That's right. But I'm getting some resistance from the Bloomfield City Council. They think I'm an alarmist."
"They ought to go visit Phoenix or Denver. That would give them a whole new attitude right quick."
Both men nodded.
Lane asked, "Say, before we talk too much grand strategy, can you tell me how you're keeping the refinery operational?"
"With a bit of Yankee ingenuity," Elroy laughed. "The staff here is excellent. You've got to understand that most modern refineries run a closed-loop, 24-hour-a-day continuous operation. The alternative to continuous ops is batch operations. Batch ops are usually confined to a specific grade of product like diesel, and any operation waste is tanked. In the old days, they simply pumped this waste in a nearby ditch. Or, if they were really green, they put it in a clay-lined open holding pond. To run a continuous op, you of course need continuous feedstock that can meet the minimum throughput and tankage for product storage for final distribution. The tricky thing is that all aspects have to be balanced to avoid stopping any of the process, whether that is feedstock delivery, throughput, or product distribution. Any bottleneck can upset the process. On the other hand, a batch op depends on a set volume of material for a set amount of yield for specific production runs and is not a reliable candidate for cogeneration due to its up-and-down nature. You need to have around 150 pounds of steam pressure. So we opted to run continuously by mothballing three of our four units. The one unit that we are running has a cogen plant just in case the local utility power has a hiccup. And that power can even backfeed, just in case their power plant goes down and it needs to be restarted. After taking a noisy breath, Martin went on. It's a bit of a scramble, keeping enough feedstock coming in, but we're working the kinks out. Lane nodded. Martin folded his hands across his chest and said, I suppose you're interested in my background, too. Here's the essentials. I spent 12 years in the Army, Signal Corps, mainly doing strategic long-haul communication systems, plus some tactical systems. In my time overseas, I saw a lot of third-world countries that were failed states. What I saw in Kosovo and in the stands colored my perspective on the current crunch. Here it is, in a nutshell. I think people here in the Four Corners are vastly underestimating the impact that the big cities to the south and north of us are going to have on us. Our neighbors think that we're in a safe, isolated area, but we're really not. Lane nodded in agreement, and Elroy went on. We're incredibly lucky here to still have electricity. Most of the country is in the dark, and because of it, they're rapidly descending into anarchy. Food is the other key resource, and here in the Southwest, water is scarce to grow crops. Most non-farming communities are at risk because they simply don't have enough calories stored to get them through any kind of crisis. But storage is no more than limited capital to allow people the time to grow more food. Food production requires land, water, and the requisite experience. On a large scale, it also takes fuel. The carrying capacity of the U.S. using traditional, non-petroleum farming techniques will be just a fraction of what most people think it would be. Also, most areas of the U.S., especially the cities, don't have anywhere near enough farmable land to go back to some kind of agrarian pattern. Without public infrastructure and modern transportation, we're going to experience a huge die-off caused mostly by starvation. Lane added, I agree. And for those left, I think it'll come down to the haves versus the have-nots. The psychologists call that the we-they paradigm. Right. In a total collapse without immediate restoration of the power grid and the economic web, basically, everyone who lives in a city is doomed unless they can take over some kind of farmland. Those that live in areas without enough farmland will be have-nots, period. I don't care how much food that survivalists have stored in their basements, it will run out someday. In the long term, it's grow food and raise livestock, or die. Elroy continued. But here's my point. Those teeming millions will not just starve and go away. I believe that any family who thinks they can defend a working farm against raiders just by themselves is delusional. Humans are dangerous. The fact is, they are the most dangerous animals on Earth. We must never lose sight of that. We are now surrounded by starving predators that are much more dangerous than tigers. It won't be like that earthquake in Haiti, where the bad guys have machetes. Here, in the U.S. of A., the vast majority will be armed with firearms. The ones currently without firearms will obtain them by any means necessary, including looting government armories. These are thinking and highly motivated enemies. They know how to read maps. Some of them have a grasp of hydrology and can appreciate the difference between
solely gravity-fed water systems and those that need grid power. They can put two and two together. Secondly, consider that raiders, the outlaw